is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi, Stacey Cole, and Todd Michaels.
The tragic Charlie Kirk shooting wasn't a heat-of-the-moment crime. This was, according to prosecutors, a deliberate act. A long gun, a rooftop, a public figure in a crowded venue. And behind it all, if the state's allegations are correct, a handwritten note, a digital trail, and more than a week of planning. Tyler James Robinson is now facing the death penalty for the killing of Charlie Kirk. The prosecution is calling it political targeting, but here's the part that matters most right now. Why does someone get to that point? Not just what they did, but how they got there. What turns a grievance into a mission? What transforms an ideology into a kill shot? And more urgently, how do we spot the warning signs before the trigger's ever pulled? Can we? Joining us, psychotherapist, forensic behavior expert, and author of many books. I'm looking around my desk right now. Here we go. I'm going to grab this one right here. The Minds of Mass Killers, probably most applicable to this conversation. Siobhan Scott, here to help us break down the psychology of targeted violence, obsession, leakage, and the quiet cues the rest of us keep missing. Let's talk about this one a bit, because there was leakage, if you will. He did talk about this a bit in ways, shapes, and forms. Let's start with what prosecutors are alleging: that written note, the text messages, the claim for over a week of planning. From a clinical standpoint, how does someone psychologically move from just a grievance into violent intent in like 7 days with no history of doing this in the past?
My guess is he had actually been thinking about it for a lot longer than 7 days. But maybe the plan, when he set the location up, you know, the plan was probably seven mm-hmm. days. But this is not something that just comes out of the blue. Killings really almost never come out of the blue, unless you're talking about a road rage situation or something like that. So I put this in the category of an ideological assassination. I don't think he was overtly political, not just driven by that. Mm-hmm. But I think he saw Charlie, and there will be differences of opinion on this. I really know sure. the two sides. He saw Charlie as causing harm. And I think he developed a sense of moral righteousness that he would be like a soldier doing the right thing by killing him. And I have to say, quite frankly, there is alarming buzz. I spend a lot of time on social media, all over social media on the right and the left, of people who have become so polarized. They make jokes about killing people on the other side. And how many times do they start fixating on that and really come up with plans? Because in truth, we are living in a war zone in the United States right now. I'm an old person, relatively speaking. And I have never seen, I lived through the 60s. I was a little kid, but, you know, I remember how contentious everything was. I have never seen the talk of violence, the calls for war, the calls for succession of states. You know, we just want to break off from the U.S. I see this psychologically. There may not be bullets flying everywhere, but there are more bullets flying and mm-hmm. people calling for civil war. And I think we're just in a very dangerous, psychic place in this country. And it's a culture war of ideas. And I think that is feeding this. We had the assassination of Melissa Hortman from Minnesota, the legislator there, and her husband and their dog.
And the dog.
A few months ago. I think we're going to be seeing more and more of these kind of things happen until we can turn the heat down in this country, if we can turn the heat down in this country.
And that's a big question. I mean, the moral righteousness, that's what seems to be the justification that people who go this far stand behind. They believe they're doing something greater. They're yes. doing something bigger. It's for a bigger, better cause. But is someone like this, Do you think he thought about his future at all? What was going through this guy's mind? Was he thinking, okay, I'm going to do this and I'm going to get away with it? Or am I going to be a hero and I'm going to somehow jury nullification is going to save me? Like we hear that word being thrown around with the assassination of the United Healthcare CEO and Luigi Mangione. What the hell? I mean, I get people having their moral righteous standpoints, and it's not super healthy no matter what side you're on, but to act and to do something like this with no seeming regard or is it ignorance of what the repercussions would be for you if you in fact go as far as this guy did?
You know, I view this as a part of the adolescent brain, because up to age 25, you've still got an adolescent kind of brain. Yeah, most parts of your brain are fully developed except for your prefrontal cortex, which makes you logical, which makes you think ahead, which makes you think about consequences. And the 18 to 24-year-olds commit a very large percentage of crime in this country and everywhere. And it's because they're impulsive and they don't think things through. They don't think about consequences. That's why car insurance rates are so much higher for teenage boys. They're 23% of the arrests in the country are males between 18 to 24 years old. Mm-hmm. And that says something about the way their brains function. You know, they're not necessarily thinking consequences through very well.
You know, and we talk about that a lot, where obviously that's physiology. That's something that we can't control the rate at which we develop. But can we control the rate at which we want to exercise it with younger people? Are we not doing enough of that? Are we doing too much of, well, it's not developed, so they're not going to do it? I don't know. There's a lot of people who, you know, can clearly look a little bit down the road at that age and not make horrible choices. Is that something that some just develop faster and then they have this ability? Are there some that literally it ain't there? It's just not there yet, so they can't make it, and there's no exercising it, and there's no teaching it, and there's no way of getting that moving and those connections happening faster than which their body will allow it to?
Yeah, I think most people who are well parented do better than those who aren't. But in all indications that we have at this point, he came from a nice family. He was well parented. So it's tricky, because to what extent is it maturation? And then we should throw in, there are some people whose brains never develop really well, and so they stay impulsive, you know, going into their adult years. And that's just sort of their lifelong pattern. It's very tricky. Again, I look at culture. We've got a gun-saturated culture, because you look at every country in the world and you've got the same brains. You've got impulsive adolescence. I mean, that's just part of the human condition. But you don't see everybody picking up guns, because there aren't guns everywhere.
I was going to ask that. So you have thousands of outraged people on both sides, thousands upon thousands. But then there are these, what, grievance collectors? Is that, I think I read that somewhere.
Robin says wound collectors.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. Similar in thought. That is there a catalyst? Is there something that pushes these people? Because, boy, I'm outraged by a lot of different things I see in today's world, and I'm not going to go into great detail, but I haven't acted. You know, I do what I can, but I'm not going to go bare arms and head to the streets. So what happens in these people's minds that they go, well, it's me or nobody. I'm going to go do this.
Yeah.
What is that?
You are not an adolescent boy. You know,
thank God.
Who plays lots of violent video games and has a lot of guns in the house. And, you know, you're just a very different person. I don't
even
go
there.
But
I do have guns. That's the difference. And we've joked on this show that I've got like six big knives located in my apartment.
Which is not healthy and should not be encouraged.
But I'm stable, and I understand when to use these things, and I know there's a lot going on in our world, but I don't feel the need to go grab my guns and head to the streets.
But that's your well-functioning prefrontal cortex. You're an intelligent woman. You're a mature woman. You can look ahead. And yes, somebody's mentioning hormones. That has testosterone. I'm sorry. Right. Men commit 90% of violent crime.
Mm-hmm. Hey, I'm in menopause, so I could be outrageous as well.
We're not going to plant that seed. But in my book, I use the term injustice collectors. And this is really a bit different than I think the perpetrator in the case we're talking about, because that fits mass shooters. And I just want to emphasize that a targeted, ideologically driven assassination is very different from somebody that goes out and tries to kill all the kids in the school or all the Jewish people in the synagogue or all the Black people in the market or the church. Those are folks who are driven with some really dark personality forces. They tend to be psychopathic, narcissistic, paranoid, and they see everything that goes wrong in their lives as this other group of people doing something to them. They tend to gamify this, so they follow each other online. They want to get higher kill scores than the other mass killers. It's got a really specific psychology, and that's really what my book is about. And so an ideologically driven assassin is very different, because usually it's one issue and something that they feel this strong, you know, this person is doing so much harm, they start fantasizing about the world would be a better place. And we're seeing so much of that. And so you just get this combination of, you know, the person is distraught about it, they've been thinking about it, and then there's an opportunity and they're good with guns and they've got access to a gun and they're a young male with an adolescent brain. And, you know, I think we're at risk for this. And then we've got the copycat thing, because when we talked about that a few weeks ago, when you have one event like this, other people, it's like they're primed. It's like, hey, I could pull this off. I could do it. I could get away with it. And that sets the stage. And so every one that happens tends to set off more.
The alleged note said, I had the opportunity to take out Charlie Kirk and I'm going to take it. What a simple note. I mean, what kind of language do you hear in that phrasing? And what does it tell you about the mindset or role identity that's going on here? I think when we think of something like this, we're expecting some manifesto that is ideological and this or that. This is just like, well, the McRib's back. I'm going to go pick one of those up. It just so callous.
Mm-hmm. I think it shows, again, that adolescent, simplistic kind of black and white. Here's an opportunity. I think this guy is spreading hate. He's doing bad things. Obviously, he was invested in his partner, who is reported to be trans. I think there's probably pretty good evidence of that. Mm-hmm. And so this felt personal to him. And in his mind, it was sort of like a surgical strike, sort of like a soldier who goes into battle. And it's like, there's the enemy, and it is just my job to take him out. And he saw it in a very black and white way.
I mean, it seems he was kind of taking on the role in his delusions of a savior. Way you're describing. I mean, can you speak to the psychology behind role adoption and what pushes someone into that frame where they feel like, okay, if I don't do this, no one's going to do this. I must be the one that's called at this moment in time. I mean, what's going on in that mind that someone thinks, well, I'm the chosen one. I know he didn't use those sort of words, but you almost have to think in the back of his mind, he must be thinking something like that if he's going to go and take out or go and do something like this.
Yeah, I think that's a little bit. I would not say there's any evidence that he has mental illness or a personality disorder, unlike mass killers who do have Either they're psychotic about 20% of the time, or they've got those personality traits, which really put them in the personality disorder category. I think in this case, it's just this sense of moral righteousness. I can make a difference here, and having the means, and yeah, a little bit of narcissistic thinking of, look, I'm going to do something really important.
Mm-hmm. You know, everybody, I'm sure, in his circle, his family, friends, anybody who interacted with him, they all are looking back and they're going, well, were there any signs? If there were signs, you know, were they missed, or could they even be acted on? If somebody's of signaling or leaking out some of their feelings. I mean, you go to any gathering of human beings right now, and if the topic turns political, you're going to have some over here and some over there and some right here. And just because someone is disagreeing with you doesn't mean that they're going to go and do something like this. From a lot of accounts, you know, he did express his distaste with Charlie Kirk. A lot of people have done that. Yeah. And there's only one that acted this way out of the gazillions that weren't fans of Charlie Kirk. Mm-hmm. So how does someone who's an observer, who's a family member, a friend, someone around this guy, and I'm not just speaking of this case alone, but in general, the world we're in right now, how does anyone know what is a signal from someone that is truly a signal of alarm versus they have a difference of opinion?
This is a really hard one in this case, because he was described as quiet, intelligent. His friends in the gaming world on Discord found him very affable. Mm-hmm. He was not doing a lot of ranting about violence. And for the mass killers who've really got the personality disorders, often there's months or even years of leakage where they're writing about murder, where, you know, if they're in the psychopathic category, they have a history of violence, they've killed animals as children. The Parkland mass killer actually would kill animals and then bring the dead animals to school. Excuse me, not a way to make friends.
That's really an interesting show and tell item now, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Wait a second. Sitting here, I'm smack dab in the middle of Wisconsin. We are heading into deer hunting season. We might even be there. I know we're duck hunting season. I was out kayaking like 2 weeks ago, and they were out on the lake shooting. We're like paddling, like, get the hell out of here. But it's a big deal around here. It wouldn't be anything weird to kill a deer and bring it to school.
There's a difference between deer hunting and, you know, going and killing small animals around your yard for fun.
Yeah, it was small animals. And he would bring them to school to upset the girls. And I mean, just look what I did. And mutilating them. And yeah, and so there are cases where the Sandy Hook killer, as of third grade, fifth grade, he was writing stories in school about murder. Mm-hmm. You know, it was like leakage, leakage, leakage. Sometimes they've posted, the Santa Barbara killer posted videos online that were really rather horrific. And, you know, so people, and sometimes, you know, they'll pose with their guns in social media and make statements, you know, I am mm-hmm. going to be the next school shooter. I mean, there has been dramatic cases where leakage was missed. So in this case, I'm not seeing that there were these warning signs.
Yeah. And I, maybe there were, maybe there weren't, we don't know of them yet at least. But in cases like you just cited, okay, leakage. They brought the animal, the dead animals to school. They were writing disturbing stories. None of those are crimes. Unfortunately, I don't know, depending how you look on it, there's nothing you can really do. You can't do lock somebody up for those sort of things. And especially if they're kids. So I think that's where so many people, and there's so many families and parents, or just concerned adults who know somebody's kid that is acting, you know, concerning. Okay, sign, 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 see something. Everybody's talking amongst themselves now. It's the do something part. Do something. I don't know if we always equate do something as law enforcement's going to step in and save the day. That's not the reality here, because there's laws that really don't allow them to do much if no crime's been committed. So it's that do something part that seems to be missing. But what are we missing in society? We're seeing something. We're saying something. What needs to be done that's not being done?
Oh, get, you know, if parents are made aware of these kind of things, stories, internet posts, Facebook, things like that, get the kid to a good therapist who specializes in adolescents and children. I close the book, the Mass Killers book, with a story of a kid that had made a threat, teenage boy, and came to therapy. And it was a pretty credible threat, other than there were no guns in the house. I think if there had been guns in the house, he might have acted on the threat. Mm-hmm. But he came to therapy. And so I sort of go through that story and how I worked with him. And he ended up taking a very different direction in life and ended up having a good life. So that's one thing. But are there other things? Yes, because maybe the family doesn't have resources. Maybe they live in a community where there, you know, aren't good options for therapy. So what we really need, and this is recommended, you know, by all the experts, are intervention teams that are made up of a person or people from law enforcement, a therapist, and people from the school. And so if somebody sees something, let's say one kid says, hey, he was talking at lunch about, you know, bringing a gun and blowing people away, you need to report that to the administrators of the school. And then they need an evaluation by a team who goes out into the home, who talks with the family, who talks about what kind of access to weapons do they have. And he may need all kinds of intervention services, or they may determine that it was an empty threat, but they're going to monitor him closely. And there aren't very many places where we have teams like that. And so that's another recommendation I make. We need really good intervention teams, and it's worth it.
Siobhan, when a troubled teen sits down in front of you for therapy and you see them having made some threats, they're angry at society, they don't fit in school, so they're claiming they're going to go do something. Where do you begin? And I don't want to derail the conversation away from what we were talking about, but what is your first step in, you need to see what's going on in this kid's mind?
You've got to build that therapeutic alliance with them and connect with them, really let them. I mean, this is in-depth therapy. It's not like a quick talk with the school counselor. You know, you've got to spend a lot of time with them, find out about what's good in their lives, what's not so good in their lives. And obviously, there's usually a laundry list of things that are not going well in their lives. So you want to help them know that you are on their side, you're rooting for them, you understand. And you know, this is pretty in-depth stuff, because number one, they may not want to be there. So mm-hmm. you have to very, in the beginning, validate, yeah, it sucks to have to go talk to somebody like me when you don't really want to do that. And usually once you start validating that, they start to trust you. And sometimes it's just like the floodgates open and you help relieve some of that pressure. And then are they really pissed off at their parents? And so you may have the parents come in for a separate session and talk about, you know, how are you coping with the stress at home? And maybe you can give the parents some other ways of interacting that are going to be more effective and work better. And then you want to help the kid find hope. Sometimes in the case I mentioned in the book, they need to be in a different school. You know, there are schools that are smaller. We had an option for high school in the, even though it was a small community I lived in, it was for kids who had special emotional needs. And so the staff, it was a very, very good staff to student ratio. The staff were all trained in counseling techniques. They got a lot of attention and they really focused on, let's work with their strengths. You've got to help help kids like that find hope. And so I'm a real believer that intervention with good therapy, with somebody who can work with kids like that, that saves lives. And we'll never know how many lives are saved because somebody got their kid connected with a good therapist.
And that's, lovely. And I completely 1000% agree. But what about the large chunk of them that are going to be coming from homes that the parents are unaware for whatever reason? They're too busy. They don't care. They're in their own world. They're like their kids. And, you know, saying there's something wrong with my kid is a direct insult on them. So we don't want to raise any sort of suspicion or any questioning of the children's mindset or behavior because they're fearful that it's going to negatively impact them. What do you do when you're the parent and your kid's telling you about somebody else at school that's doing something a bit weird and off and it's reported, but therapy's not required? You can't mandate, you can't make therapy mandatory, at least not right now. And these things just kind of fester. You can't, like, you don't want to pull your kid out of school. Unless the threat's like, something's going to happen tomorrow or something of that nature, but it lingers. And then we all just, as the rest of society, have to put up with every horrible parent's poor decision-making for little Jimmy that they can't admit has some problems and needs some help, but is not getting that help.
And another thing that happens, I last time I looked at data, it was only 30% of the schools had an embedded mental health counselor, not just an academic counselor, but a mental health counselor in school. And sometimes you can get kids care that way. Of course, yeah. My bias is we need an embedded mental health counselor in every school.
In every classroom. Because the reality is, okay, great, you have one in your school for how many hundreds of children?
Right. Right. Yeah. And we're talking now in the government of pulling all mental health people out of school, right? Kids don't need that. They just need the Ten Commandments written on the wall in the classroom.
And every kid deserves a Smith and Wesson at their desk.
Right. Right. You know? Yeah. Right. And you know, bottom line, if let's say my kid comes home and said, you know, Josh at school says he's got a gun and in the next 3 days he's going to come and take it out on, you know, Mrs. Jones' math class or something. 1-800 call FBI. Yeah. I mean, make that call.
We're talking with Siobhan Scott about the Charlie Kirk assassination. What happens next? What's going on? What was going on in the mind of his assassin? And where, you know, where we're at in our country, where things are going, where we're at. And, you know, the threats, the reality, the uncomfortable atmospheres that all of us live in, no matter, you know, who you are, where you are, if you have kids in school, if you don't, there's so many questions swirling around our safety right now. And the see something, say something, but do something seems to be the missing part. That's what we're digging into today. I want to ask you this, Siobhan, and I have a story I'll add to it. How much problem is there with burnout amongst educators, amongst authorities, amongst counselors within their schools, we see something, we say something, and now, you know, we're going to notify who we're supposed to notify, but nothing happens. And then eventually they're just like, well, why do I keep calling the police? Why do I keep calling the FBI? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I'm saying this because I actually had this very conversation yesterday. I got a call from a school, my child's school, about some information that she learned about another human being that was not good information. And she reported it. And I won't go into what the details were, but the school called me and said, hey, you know, and now she's really anxious about what she reported because she doesn't want the repercussions from the kids of, you know, how is when they reported this. We talked about that a bit. And then when I talked to the school, here's what I got. And I like the school. I'm not trying to rip on the school. I'm not going to say the school, but I said, okay, so I'm just curious now that you have this information, what do you do with it? And I know you can't tell me details of, you know, anybody's family or parents, but like, how do you, what is the process that you go through? Cause I wanted to challenge it to see what it was.
That's good.
And the response I got was, well, we let the parents know.
Oh.
And then I said, okay. And?
That's a wild card.
And I said, so are you, you're relying on those parents of these kids that are already making these horrible decisions. And again, look, you can be a great parent and your kid can make horrible decisions. I'm not saying that. But we just got to consider the source of where these things are coming from. And you're relying on them to then make the right choice or like to do what is needed to tamper this down and stop this. Well, we can't judge. We can't judge the parents. I said, you can and you can't. I know what you're saying. I know legally you can't judge, blah, 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 blah. But I said, okay, answer me this. You're a mandatory reporter, right? Yes. I said, okay. I work in true crime every day. And here's what I see a lot. Mandatory seems to be the option.
Yes.
And people seem to be going down this world, and there seems to be so many mandatory reporters that feel it's a lot more optional than it is mandatory. I said, so what does mandatory reporting mean? Mm-hmm. Well, that we have to report it to the FBI or to the police. I'm like, okay, so what was missing from that process we just talked about there?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Then what, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, normally, then I got the excuse. Then I got the, well, you know, so when we call, you know, some, you know, nothing happens. I said, but it's on record.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I said, that's the part you're missing.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to at least be on record. So then the next time this happens, which it will, there's something else to go off of. And it's not just, well, we told the parents and the parents didn't do anything. Because surprise, surprise, a high percentage of these folks and the parents don't give a shit about their kids very much. That's why their kids are doing what they're doing. So then to rely on the very source that brought them into the world to be responsible, to not let little Jimmy go off the rails, who's already way the fuck off the rails, to suddenly pull them back in, that's insane. Mm-hmm. That judge away. Judge mm-hmm. the shit out of that, because it's not going to fix the problem. They're not going to fix the problem. But my point is the burnout, and I felt bad for this, and I wasn't trying to be an asshole. I kind of was. But I wasn't trying to, but I was just kind of like, this is the problem. Right. This is where we're assuming it's going to be solved over here, and we can take it off our plate. I can check the box that says, I did this when you really didn't do shit.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let's talk about that now that I'm going to step off my little box of ivory soap.
Yeah, I see so much educator burnout, and it's a very hard time to be a teacher because they are expected to basically reparent a lot of kids who are not being well parented at home, don't have social skills, are aggressive and act out and can't control themselves directly because of inadequate parenting at home. So that's a huge problem. And then even if it is reported to law enforcement, more cases in my book where that ball was dropped, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, terrible cases where the ball was dropped. And again, it's not always dropped. And I think a lot of cases are interrupted, but it often is. And so we need that team intervention where a kid is flagged. Immediately, the team meets with mental health, someone from law enforcement, and someone from the school, and they develop a plan. Okay, what are we going to do here? How do we follow up? How are we going to monitor? Mm-hmm. But I think also of the parents of the Michigan high school shooter a couple years ago, where they were encouraging him. Mm-hmm. And this was a really disturbed kid. Mm-hmm. And they bought him the AR-15 and supplied the bullets. And he was posting really threatening kinds of things on Facebook with his gun. And, you know, they ended up convicted because of that. And so, the sad, ugly truth is that's another factor. And I think all the mass shootings is in some cases, you know, parents weren't doing anything wrong. There were other factors, you know, largely the internet influences that the kids had gotten into. But sometimes you're right. You've got inadequate parents. So calling the parents and saying, oh, guess what he said today? Well, maybe that's the way dad talks around the dinner table at home, you know, about who he wants to kill. And it's Well, man, it's hard.
And people don't like being accused of being inadequate, especially as a parent. And they don't like being, you know, pointed out what's wrong. And sorry, that's the reality in some of these situations. And I get the burnout. I mean, how many times can you do the same action over and over with no real meaningful resolution? And then you get, you know, me who's like, why aren't you doing this? Yeah. And I get why. But but then it just ends in a stalemate because and eventually she was like, I'm going to call the FBI. Thank you. I'm going to hold you accountable for this. Please do what you're supposed to do.
Yeah.
You know, I appreciate that this needs to be known. But when you have it over and over, you know, you get to that point of feeling, you know, it's almost like a level of hopelessness.
It does become a hopelessness and overwhelming. And I have to say, I see so many teachers leaving the profession. Yeah. Mm-hmm. People that went into it because they love kids, they care deeply. I think they do wonderful work. But the social problems that they are running into, and they do their best, but they can't. Yeah. They can't fix it. And it's just eating them up.
No, we shouldn't be relying on teachers to be parents when we're also tying their hands to any sort of parental or any sort of directional skills that they should be giving children, but they can't because, well, you don't want to hurt their feelings too, because the second that happens, then, oh, well, then it's the teacher's fault. And then they just give up. They're like, I'm going to check the boxes. I'm going to do this until I'm going to collect my pension and get the hell out of Dodge. Mm-hmm. And that seems to be the attitude of so many teachers right now. And I see it firsthand. I'm friends. I'm very close with many and that are my age that got into the profession and now they're only in their 40s. They're not going to retire. They're not going to be, you know, the 60-year-old teacher someday that's like, I did my whole, you know, life and this is great. They're like, I'm out.
Yeah, they're going to Starbucks. It's just easier.
I can't deal with this for my own well-being. I mean, is this, I mean, and again, and you look, well, what's the problem with that? Well, the system's not enabling any sort of real meaningful change or help that needs to go on with some of these kids and allow the educators to do their job and to help. And the resources are simply not there. So then we have that issue that we go into. It's a circle of fear. The schools don't want to admit there's a problem. They don't want any sort of negative publicity. We don't want to make anybody feel uncomfortable. We don't want to, you know, it's always fear. It's some reason why we're not doing what we're supposed to be doing. And if you go to the next person on the scale, that's the reason. And it just keeps going. Mm-hmm. It's a culture of fear that we're living in for various reasons as to why systemically it all fails then.
Mm-hmm. Very much so. Very much so. And it also makes me wonder, at one point I looked up the data on how many calls does the FBI get in a day about potential threats. And it was overwhelming.
Yeah.
And so how effective can you've got some FBI folks on the show. I mean, that would be interesting to talk to them. What is staffing in the FBI like at this point? And how able are they to follow up when, you know, there's a threat about a high school somewhere?
Have to have the head of the FBI taking it upon himself to fly specific things to places personally so he can take credit and put his name in front of everything, you got problems. Mm-hmm. It gets a little inefficient when you start doing or not doing your job, you know, effectively. The acted here, it wasn't a private confrontation, obviously. It was, you know, a long-range shot during a large public event. What does that kind of setting suggest psychologically about what this was about? That it was a very public thing, that this wasn't something where someone plotted to do it, you know, where there wasn't a large crowd. Does the crowd play into this? And does that play into the minds of people like this, where they want to do it in some sort of a spectacle sort of way?
Sometimes it does. I'm not sure in this case. It may just have been this is an easy opportunity because there's an open space. There's a roof. I will have a good angle for shooting. And that could have been as complicated as it got. Was he trying to make a statement to freak a bunch of people out? That's possible. But I didn't get the sense from anything we know thus far that he had any intention to hurt anyone else other than to just eliminate who he saw as his enemy.
Well, and the strange part of this is this could have gone so terribly wrong. It did go terribly wrong. And don't get me wrong there. Obviously, a life was lost, but there were thousands of college students
worse.
There.
Yes.
Yeah, it could have been horrific.
Yeah,
this could have been a mass shooting. So
could have, but that wasn't his intent. His intent was not to make it a mass shooting.
No, but what if he missed? What if he was nervous? Mm-hmm. What if he picked off three or four people in front and then kept going? Mm-hmm. There were just so many variables here. Mm-hmm. So, you know, was this something that he was practicing for, or was he just that good a shot and decided I need to do this?
He was an avid video game player, first person shooter. And I'm not saying video games cause people to do things like this, but they get good. You get good.
But there's such a difference. You know, I've talked about how I've gone to the shooting range many times, and there's such a marked difference between holding that gun in your hand and feeling that kickback versus I'm just playing a video game. He was really a great shot. So to me, I want to know.
No, his family, they practice. He learned how to do it. He learned how to do it. I mean, and then if you're every day sitting there simulating murder simulation on your video games, you know, you end up losing that the normalcy becomes what it is.
Yeah.
It becomes normal.
Yeah.
And that's just it. It feels very different to all of a sudden. You're pointing at a human being versus a screen.
But it's not a human anymore.
Right. And you know what? When I've worked with soldiers who came home from Afghanistan, I said, how did you do this? Because they were very nice people. They were not psychopathic. They were sensitive guys. And they had their own post-war trauma. But I said, what was it like for you to be a sniper and to be taking a human life? And they said, I pretended I was playing a video game because I was a gamer. And that's where I just went. I had to hit the target. And so they were able to dissociate, I think, from the fact it's a target and they're not up close. It's not like they're stabbing someone, you know, it's just, same thing with the people who use drones. Mm-hmm. It's very much like a video game. I've talked to them because they will assassinate, you know, at remote distances with a drone. And so it's that desensitization process that they go through.
And it looks just like a video game on a drone.
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's identical. I mean, and if you can get into that mindset and then you get so desensitized to reality. The term that gets thrown around on this one, and really in all mass, he snapped. He must have went crazy. Obviously, it goes far deeper than that to get in front of any of this. And we've talked about all sorts of lovely ways that, you know, if enacted, you know, would save lives, without a doubt. Is our society remotely intelligent enough or smart enough to actually do any of these things? And if they're not, to the level to which we described, how the hell do we get there? What on a simplistic level? I mean, because at the end of the day, you know, the mindset of most people is basically operating 8-year-olds in adult bodies. How do we communicate this to the people that need to have this communicated of what to look out for, how to get into a better place? Siobhan, solve the world's problems right now.
I know. Right now, huh? You've got 4 minutes. Go for
it. That's why I write these books, right? It's like I get really, my books are the result of me being frustrated.
Sure.
And if something is bugging me and I'm writing about it over and over and trying to educate people, it's like, okay, let's just put a book out here and see if anybody will read it. But of course, the people who need to read these kind of books aren't reading.
Right? No. No.
They're not. They're out at the shooting galleries.
Yeah, they're playing Call of Duty.
Yeah, exactly. So it's my frustration. I acknowledge some burnout over it. We keep talking about it, just like you like to do. We keep pushing prevention. We keep pushing the need for for mental health people in school that can catch the third grader writing stories about murder. We want to keep plugging away at it, but it does feel like, you know, bailing the ocean with a teaspoon sometimes. And the more and more time kids are disengaged from real world and social relationships and productive activities, the more time they spend online going to very dark, unhealthy places. It's a concern. I think that's why we're seeing so many more mental health problems in kids, because they're not spending time in productive activities, real life activities. They're off in the virtual world and they're not in good places, you know, many of them.
I mean, Go ahead, Stacey. What is the difference between a budding serial killer or a budding mass shooter and maybe an up-and-coming Stephen King in third grade with a vivid imagination?
One shops at Borders, one shops at Walmart, one shops at Target. There's your difference.
It just popped up, you know, in my brain. Like, I've known some of these dark individuals who wear all black and they wear capes and they write
me on Halloween or and other times.
Yeah, Siobhan.
Yeah.
But, you know, what is the difference between just this creative soul that you don't want to crush, you know, in third grade, but they're dark?
I think there's a difference. It may be subtle sometimes between kids, let's say the goth lifestyle. My daughter, right, is into the goth lifestyle. But that's different than writing a story as a young child about cutting your mother's head off. You know what I mean? It's the degree of violence. And I've often said, I mean, I would be kind of, I think he's mellowed out in his old age, but I would have always felt a bit uneasy living next door to Stephen King or having him over for dinner. I mean, you know, what's all the, because some of his stuff, especially the early stuff, was really, really horror. I mean, that's, he writes horror, right? But really horrifying. And I would, somebody would recommend a book and I would read the book and I'd go, oh my God, I'm traumatized after, you know, I'd have to flip pages ahead. Yeah. So it's maybe a subtle difference, but I think kids who are showing those fascinations really young, it's worth taking a look at. And, and I particularly in the '90s with the whole alternative goth movement and all the music and, you know, people were really worried. I had those kids come into therapy, but it was pretty easy to tell that most of them, it was just benign, you know, it really wasn't something that they were focused on, fixated. Often they loved their animals and, you know, they were kind. They weren't out killing the puppies. I mean, you know, you can suss that out.
Sure.
Back when Marilyn Manson was the worst of our problems.
I do. Remember those days? Remember that?
Kiss. Wow. Yeah.
I want to say, I mean, this is just kind of an observation I've made as someone, you know, I was born in the 80s. I grew up, you know, I was born in 82. So I grew up in the 90s and I was in the world of, you know, the most violent game was Mortal Kombat. And that was the big one.
That was a big controversy.
Back then, big controversy.
I found out my son was playing it and I had a talk with him about it. And then then it turned out he was the champion of the county at Mortal Kombat at one of the big arcades he would go to. And I went in there and I saw his name on a plaque at the wall, Matt, the champion of Mortal Kombat. I had a little meltdown about it. You know, we had to talk about it. Yeah.
Outside the studio, I have all of the actual arcade machines. So I still enjoy the game. Yeah. But it's, you know, that was the big thing. And then we got into the world where things got a little more crazy. The Grand Theft Autos of the world came out. I was like 18, 19 when Grand Theft Auto 3 came out. That was the first one that was real. It was the open world and you can walk around and you're just shooting up things. And there's missions and all that, but it was kind of like, it was shocking. And I remember playing it at that age, you know, and the shock value was, oh my God, this is crazy. Thank God we don't live in a world like this. 25 years later, we live in a world like that.
We do.
It's literally like Grand Theft Auto. The video game has become far closer to reality than a satire of reality. And I think it's it's a very interesting game. And I'm not like anti, and I don't play many games anymore, but I don't know that the answer ever has been or ever will be, let's get rid of video games or anything like that. But what, and I always thought that was silly, you know, when those arguments were being made back then. But I mean, come on, we're talking something very different than what Mortal Kombat or Street Fighter was versus what is being fed into these very young minds and what we understand of how our brains work and how we develop and how we desensitize, all these things that we know far more about now than we did in 1993. Do we need to take a look at this a little bit? Because I know, well, we put the labels on that says 18 years or older, blah, 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 whatever. None of it does anything.
8-year-olds are playing this.
Exactly. Yeah. So, but do we need a little bit of a reckoning here? Do we need to say, like, this is not okay. This is not healthy. We can't keep feeding our kids this shit and just letting them run rampant with it and then go, well, kids will be kids. I can't stop them. You're the adult.
Yeah.
Yes, you can stop them. You're the adult.
You're the adult.
Try being one. But then the adult's like, I like playing it too. And I can say, I'm guilty of this shit. Right. I've played Grand Theft Auto with my daughter. Yeah. And she's like, holy shit, this is crazy. And I don't worry that she's going to go do any of that. Right. But that there's a difference there. There's some, I don't know. Like, I don't know how you could police it, can police it, should police it. I don't know. But there is a huge difference in the world since Grand Theft Auto and then the world of Call of Duties and everything else have come into complete mainstream life and acceptance, where you have kids playing it and their 40-year-old dad is doing it as well. We're in a very different place since we've started murder simulating in our living rooms on a daily basis.
And that's the perfect way to put it. It's murder simulation, one of the most horrifying games, because I did a book on video game addiction, and I used to do a lot of game research, including playing them with my sons.
Yeah.
And the most horrifying one I saw was created in Japan, and it was a very graphic game where the goal was to rape.
Jesus.
Ooh. And explicit and very sexualized.
We thought our games were bad here.
And, well, you could get it here.
God.
Yeah, yeah, and probably still can, so I won't name the game. But yeah, you consider 8-year-olds, 9-year-olds, 10-year-olds playing rape simulations, not to mention murder simulations. And so when we look at turning down the heat in our culture politically, trying to find more common ground, get people to stop thinking with such extremist ideology, and giving our kids more pro-social positive activities, because it also has a lot to do with the amount of hours they're spending on games versus doing productive activities in the real world where they're making friends and you know, playing sports, doing scouts, you know, things that are healthier for them. Because a lot of these kids that have done mass shootings, they're playing violent games all the time.
Yeah.
And so it's not necessarily that they're you know, playing a violent game, but it's the amount of time they're playing. And some of them have used the games as rehearsals. So they play in a qualitatively different way.
If they were just going to harness this for good, can you imagine what they'd accomplish?
Well, if we can get into their worlds, and again, that requires parenting, that requires parents being parents, which ultimately is probably the answer to 99% of these problems of parents not being parents, is getting in there and showing these kids and their brains, you know, you're not going to have a conversation and go, you're going to like doing this better than playing the game. No, I'm not the game. I like it. It's getting into their heads and showing the reward of something other than the video game that's just feeding it right at that moment in time over and over and over, showing them a reward that makes them go, oh, this is a lot more enjoyable than sitting here and doing this.
Yeah.
But again, requires parenting.
Yeah, huh. Making life worth living in positive ways. I think we all need that. We have to feel productive. We have to find joy. We have to have healthy human relationships with real people in the real world and not just get lost.
Yeah, and it's hard. It's hard. I mean, look, I'm a parent. You're a parent. It's hard. I can say I'm guilty of a bunch of the things I'm criticizing.
But it's
a matter of really just stepping up. And unless parents start doing that and getting involved in their children's lives, and I know kids, mom, dad, you go over there or what, you know, it's your job. Mm-hmm. Start doing it, you know, and I can say that to myself too.
Me too.
It's something we all need to be aware of because nothing's going to change unless that starts happening. Mm-hmm. Siobhan Scott, psychotherapist, author of this book, The Minds of Mass Killers, and your memoir, which is also out right now, Nightbird, available wherever books are sold. Please go and check all of that out. Thank you so much. I dropped a bottle on the dog.
Excellent. Great.
It's an empty bottle of juice. You're good. please go and check that out. Until next time, for Siobhan, for Todd and Stacey, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.